Hello, everyone. Welcome to a very special episode of Uncanny Treks as we start our march through the Batman Gotham Knights series. It's rather a strange series to go through. It's maybe not what you would go to if you were picking best Batman series, but because it's a strange series and because it continues the Hush saga eventually, a long time from now, that's where we're going. I'm Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland. Matt, how you doing this evening?
Doing okay, Bob. Man, I remember reading some of these Gotham Knights issues as a child. Not these specific issues today, but just parts of the series. I guess it ran for about 75 issues or so.
That's right. 74, actually, I think. They couldn't even get that. I think they couldn't even get the 75th out.
And it felt like they were trying to make very large-scale changes to Batman's mythos, but they never stuck. And that's why I'm excited about going back and reading this, because we're going to talk about some things that I don't think ever get brought back up in Batman. At least to my knowledge.
Do you feel like that's the case with these issues in particular, the first 12 issues of Gotham Knights we're talking about? Or do you feel like that's more the case when, spoilers for people who haven't read Gotham Knights, we're going to find out that Bane might be Batman's half-brother. We're going to have Hush return.
Even with these issues that we're going to talk about tonight, Bob, there's still some things that I'm not even sure if they're considered canon or not, or if they ever were. And if this is just if they've been introduced in these issues, you're going to have to help me out a little bit with that. I'm a pretty big Batman fan, but man, some of this I'm not even sure of because there's some relationships and things, but we'll get into it as we break through the issues.
I'm scrolling down to the first issue to check, and I think maybe part of what the thing is, that why some of the changes made in this don't stick, is this is, I think, the final era of Batman comics edited by Denny O'Neil. And so I think some of the changes Devin Grayson is making, or some of the wrinkles she's adding, it's adding on to O'Neil's vision of what the Batman family should be. And because within a couple years of this, I think Denny O'Neil is no longer the editor, and you get new editors. I think Bob Schreck is the guy who takes over. And you go into a different direction with Hush, which is what we talked about a week or two ago. I think that different direction changes maybe explains why these things don't feel canon or they didn't really stick. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. When you switch up editors, you're going to have changes, big changes. And plus, we get a lot of different things around this era. These dropped in 2000, so right at the turn of the century. And we're talking pre-Hush, we're talking pre-New 52, all that stuff that happens like afterward. There's plenty of ways they can wipe these out without any issue.
But that said, I still think technically, I think someone could correct me if I'm mistaken, but technically, unlike basically every other DC character, I think Batman's history and Green Lantern and Hal Jordan, I think their histories are largely intact. Everybody else gets the full restart from New 52 and then a weird merge with Rebirth. But I think with Batman and with Hal Jordan specifically, that fans and creators liked where the Batman and Green Lantern comics were right before the New 52. And so the New 52 actually doesn't represent much of a break, has always been my understanding.
They were very subtle with how, if there were changes, they left it open-ended, and they were subtle about how they made the changes, at least with New 52. If I remember correctly, Batman, it was kind of left open-ended, like, maybe it did happen that way. Maybe it didn't. Maybe Nightfall did happen before Batman met. They're still great stories, and you don't want to mess with that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. One other matter I wanted to cover before we try to blaze through these 12 issues. Matt, do you know anything about Devin Grayson? She's the writer on this issue, and I believe I'm correct in saying that she's the first woman writer to have a regular Batman writing gig.
That is correct. And the thing is, Bob, unfortunately, I remember for one infamous thing that she did, that she wrote about, and it was the Rape of Nightwing by Tarantula. Very controversial.
Yeah. And to be honest, I've really not read much of that Nightwing series. And so I just don't have an opinion on that one way or the other.
Yeah. I mean, I just remember it being a thing. That's where her name just stands out to me. I'm like, oh, yeah, Devin Grayson.
And apparently she is a big Nightwing fan. So that her getting to take over Nightwing was a big deal at the time.
Yeah.
Well, so this is a Batman book, if you don't know, and it's more focused on the Batman family, and you'll see that as we walk through these issues. So just to start with number one, it's called Constance. Matt, what do you want to begin with for Constance?
Well, this story is about Batman hunting down the murderer of a family, and you're thinking, oh, it's like some criminal or something, but it winds up being their kid, their son, the little boy. And I've heard this story before, Bob, very recently, by one of your favorite authors.
What do you prefer, Matt? Do you prefer the Gotham Knights version or do you prefer the Batman Broken City version?
I prefer this version, Bob, since it came first.
I would bet you money Azzarello had not read this comic. I would bet you good money.
You don't think Azzarello read Devin Grayson's comic?
I don't think it's a reflection on Devin Grayson. I don't think Azzarello read that many Batman comics. And you might hear that. You might hear that, listeners. And Matt's going to hear that, listeners, as an insult. I mean that as a compliment. Unlike you fanboys out there in Radio Land, I think you sometimes want people who haven't read a lot of the comics to write the comics because you get more interesting ideas that way. Yeah. Or, but maybe sometimes you do get stories that were done in fairly obscure titles 5 or 6 years before. Yes, I admit that does sometimes happen.
Right. Well, it's also weird, Bob, too, because didn't Azzarello do a backup story for some of these? So he should have at least picked up the title, I would hope.
Why would he pick up the title?
He doesn't read his own work.
Matt, you know who reads their own work? Narcissist.
Jeez. All right. Brad Azzarello.
Oh, ride or die for Az. I will note that for the art on issue number one, Constance, as well as the art for issues 5 and issues 2, we have Dale Eaglesham. I don't know if Matt's seen him on anything. I mostly associate him with Punisher Year 1 and the Justice Society of America.
Yeah, Matt's not read any of those.
Fair. Okay. Well, and then one little interesting bit of real world trivia I wanted to drop on you. So the father who's killed in this issue by his son, spoilers, is not just any father, Matt, but he's the Republican senator. And since Gotham is technically in New Jersey, which I don't think anything in this issue disputes, usually Gotham is understood to be in New Jersey. I looked it up. And the last time a Republican won an election in New Jersey was 1972. Now, there have been other Republican senators appointed since then when you had a Republican governor of New Jersey. Mm-hmm. But the last time a Republican actually won Senate election in New Jersey was 1972. So maybe we're stretching the realism a little bit to have a Republican senator.
Yeah. Since Gotham's an island, is it just supposed to float out the side of New Jersey?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right.
That was a weird way to put that, but you know what I mean.
I think it would have to be in southern New Jersey, right? Because it needs to be in pretty close proximity to Metropolis, which is, I think, supposed to be in northern Delaware.
Okay, that makes sense. This is hot off No Man's Land. So we still have a lot of the No Man's Land stuff coming through. And they do mention some of the gangs and like how they're repairing the city afterward. Bruce is rebuilding Wayne Manor. That's the B plot here.
I did want to ask you a question about No Man's Land. We have a mention of a street gang. We don't really see much of them in this issue, but there's a mention of a street gang called the who were, you know, referenced as being big in No Man's Land. So Xhosa is an ethnic group in South Africa. And I was wondering, do you remember in No Man's Land, is that group actually South African, or is it just a case of somebody like the way that name sounded and just took it for a gang name?
Well, I'm going to say the other two gang names, Bob, you've got Street Demons and Low Boys. You maybe want to go back and reread No Man's Land, honest to God, because it's so good. And I remember collecting all trades. And now I want to go back and actually see if these gangs were represented in this. If there's some like racial stuff going on here.
You assume there is based on the other names, but I don't know.
I remember No Man's Land. I remember the finale, but I know there's so much more involved with it. And I did read the novelization by Rucka, which was pretty good.
One other geography note that this issue raised, because it raises a lot of geography notes. So we see Dick Grayson on a motorcycle, and we see two different signs. One sign says that Gotham, or the outskirts of Gotham where Dick is riding on the motorcycle, is 30 miles to Bloemhaven, his city, 310 miles to Baltimore, and 870 miles to our beloved ATL. And then as he turns back the other way, we see that he's 12 miles outside of Gotham. He's 112 miles outside of Boston, and he's 236 miles outside of Ivytown, which would, at least in the terms of where the places are located, would seem to suggest that Gotham is in New Jersey or New York State.
Honestly, all those numbers you just rattled off, I feel like this is some elementary school math problem. You give me a blank map and I've got to figure out where everything is.
Wait till we introduce the dimension of time, man.
Get my ruler out and make sure I'm measuring up to the correct scale. That's crazy.
You had a question about the reconstruction of Wayne Manor, Matt.
How did they actually rebuild Wayne Manor on top of the Batcave?
If I'm gonna no-prize it, I guess the explanation would be the cave isn't that accessible to the manor, right? Because in most versions of the myth, Thomas knows that there are caves there, but it's not like they're that accessible, right?
Right.
And presumably the manor was originally built there without falling into the caverns. So presumably you could manage it. And then, I don't know, maybe Batman also covers up the main entrances or something just so no worker gets lost and pulls an 8-year-old Bruce and falls through the ground into the cave.
And Bob, I feel like such a mark saying this because I've seen pictures of the Batcave and there's no way any man could build any of that crap by himself or with just Alfred or his kids. I've worked with my father trying to build things. It's not that it's not easy. I get that. I have to suspend my belief here. And also, if you think about Dark Knight Rises in the movie, he did the exact same thing. No explanation.
This is true.
So this issue starts off, you have this narrator and you assume it's Batman, maybe, or someone else, or a villain or something, but they're talking from a case file. They have a case file on Batman. They have a case file on these other characters. They have a case file on, and it's, did you like that?
I can't really entertain the mystery of it because I know very well from other people talking about it who the narrator is.
Right.
And so there's no miss. And also some of the trade jargon he's using is kind of a tell. If I didn't know the solution, I probably would be more apt to find it irritating.
Gotcha. I mean, they were just using it as a way to lead up to who the villain is. We do find that out later on down, like, what, towards issue 8?
We have issue number 2 is Down with the Ship. What goes down and down with the ship, Matt?
So, Bob, Batman and Cassie, Batgirl, they rescue victims of human trafficking on a ship.
I do want to start by noting that the Brian Bolan, the artist of The Killing Joke, draws the Cassie Kane on this cover. And seeing the way Brian Bolan draws Cassie Kane, little surreal, not what you expect. And like you're saying, this is very post No Man's Land. So Cassie is still very much having to shake off her programming from David Kane. And also, I think Lady Shiva, or maybe just David Kane. Yeah. I know Lady Shiva is the mom, but I can't remember how involved she is in the training or programming of her.
I've got to reread No Man's Land.
We see Batman do some tough love. She abandons her. Yeah. And we see Batman do some tough love on Cassie. And you weren't into it.
Let's say more like Miller's all-star Batman and Robin here. He comes off way too harsh. And it reminds me of that the way that version of Batman treated Robin. He just leaves her there to die. And he acts like he could still save her, but I don't see that. But anyway, the way that her body language is drawn in that suit is interesting because you can't see her facial expressions. She's got no mouth. Yeah. You can't see her eyes. So the only way they can...
Body language is everything.
It's everything with Cassie. And they do a fantastic job of showing her fear when Batman abandons her. I really appreciate that part. That's one thing I liked about Cassie in this role where she wasn't talking. You had to be really smart. The artist had to be really specific about how they did things.
It is a really interesting challenge about how to convey emotions from her. I don't know. I've maybe had a more positive reading of Batman needs her to do this work because of the way she's been trained. If she doesn't do this positive work, sometimes you see this as an explanation for why he had to adopt Dick and Jason, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
Of what would they have become if he hadn't adopted them? You can find that persuasive or no, but I think that's very much in play with Cassie. She has to ultimately decide that she doesn't just have a death wish, that she isn't going to take crazy risk in the field. Maybe this is not the best way to deal with a death wish or suicidal ideation, but I wouldn't necessarily compare it to Miller. But now that you say that, it maybe makes me think I should have read it more carefully. And maybe I would have had a different opinion had I read it more carefully.
But Bob, you go back and you look at the art, yeah, body language is important, but we get the final scene that reminds us that Cassie is actually a teenager and because she's recreating the whole Titanic thing on the boat.
Does that make either Stephanie Brown or Tim Drake her Leo DiCaprio?
I think David Kane had that dual VHS set of Titanic sitting on his tin by his
teeth. He's making her take notes during it of, okay, how would you kill each survivor?
How would you escape Titanic? Technically, that's what she did. She escaped her old version, Bob, Titanic.
But instead of Jack, it's Batman who's, well, you better swim. Issues 3 and 4, two-parter named Samsara. Paul Ryan does the art for both of these issues as well as the art for issue 6 and 7. I mostly know Paul Ryan because he drew an early 90s Fantastic Four run with Tom DeFalco. Matt, it's where the Fantastic Four goes super 90s. There's muscles, there's identity changes, Invisible Woman gets a boob window, there's time travel.
Oh, that one. Okay, yeah, everybody knows about that one. Yeah.
Everybody knows that. Nathaniel come back as like Cable. It's really not a good run, man. I wanted to like it because it sounds hilarious when I describe it, but it's not. Well, let me say one other thing about Ryan. I wanted to see if you felt this. So Ryan has a very strange style, very, very strange style. I don't really know how to characterize it. And then Batman's in the year one costume he was after No Man's Land. And for whatever reason, Paul Ryan's style and the year one costume, it just makes all the Paul Ryan issues feel like weird golden age issues to me. Did you feel that? It's like trying to recreate the golden age. I don't think that's actually what they were going for. It's just what happened for me, at least.
Looking at the art, yes, I could see what you're saying. And I know this sounds weird, but Batman seems smaller. And his ears are shorter. He doesn't have the armored look that you get, you're used to seeing. That's the problem, though. The armor look came after Hush. That armored look is not there. He has that more soft-looking suit.
Interesting. I think you're right about that. Now, before you tell us the plot summary.
Anyway, yeah, Bob, on page four, I know when we were reading Hush, Bob, if you remember, I made a mistake. I said that I feel like Hush introduced a lot of the technology pieces that come with Batman's cowl. Because we didn't see that in Nightfall. We didn't see that in the mid-90s. But we already see it here, though. He's using the infrared lenses, which was surprising to me. Because in the other issues that I looked at in Detective Comics, he's still whipping out giant tools and stuff. And things that things that were actually realistic. Things you could actually use and see in real life people using. Not these special computer-based lenses that they would not have had in the year 2000.
Well, Matt, you fooled me because I believed you. I believed Hush was the invention of the more technological Batman. Now, what goes on in this two-parter, Samsara?
Batman investigates a string of possessions by an 8-year-old boy who died in a car accident.
I'd say this is one of the weaker sets of issues of this 12. But Matt, on the bright side, we get our third consecutive Killer Croc appearance. We saw him in Hush, we saw him in Broken City, and we see him here.
Yeah, Killer Croc is basically the go-to recognizable street muscle for Batman to fight. If they need somebody for Batman to fight that's strong, muscly, they're not going to pull Bane because Bane's too intelligent. Bane has too much backstory. Mm-hmm. Killer Croc, you can beat him every issue you want. It doesn't matter.
He can be a pimp. He can be a mutant. He can be both.
Whatever you need him to be, he's there. Same way that Penguin is the intel guy, which we'll talk about a little later.
To move on to issue number 5, Locked, what happens in that issue?
So, Bob, Batman teams up with Azrael to take down the Key, who has used his powers to unlock Batman killer instinct.
Matt, do you remember the 95 version of the Key that debuts early in Grant Morrison's JLA?
His was from the 60s and the 70s, and he had a key blaster, he had a key on his head, weird looking stuff. But my understanding is they reworked his origin or his story, that he went into this drug induced coma after all that, and his powers just increased in strength. And now he's able to mind control and all kinds of crazy stuff.
This is years old, but I remember reading an interview with Morrison where they said that they couldn't find a common thread for the Key. They went back and read the Key's old appearances and they couldn't make any sense of his purpose or goals or powers. And so on the one hand, the 90sification of the Key, it was the 90s and that's what you did. But it was also a little bit trying to give some sense to this evocatively named, but apparently very vague Silver Age Justice League villain.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy for Morrison to struggle with trying to find a way to make that work. We just had to completely put him in a coma and just change everything about him.
Speaking of radical character redesigns, had you totally forgotten about JPV, John Paul Valley's long hair costume? I'd totally forgotten about it until I saw it here, and I was just, oh my God.
I did too. This is the stupidest look I've ever seen on the character, Bob. I don't know. He switches to this costume midway through the Azrael Agent of the Bat series. His age is about 50. So you look. I know Bob's reading through that now. So that's something to look forward to, Bob.
Yeah, I'm only up to like issue 13 now or something.
It was meant to make him look more like a hero, but he comes off as this like Wildstorm looking creation. But he does go back to the more traditional armored look because people just hate it. People even then didn't like this. It's not Azrael. It just looks stupid.
I totally think you nailed it with the Wildstorm look for the long hair JPV. But even though as bad as he looks, I did like how this comic portrayed John Paul Valley and Cassie Kane's relationship. They actually do make an interesting duo. And it does make me sad that I don't think their time in the Batman family overlaps very much. So there might be some potential to explore that in future incarnations in the Batman family.
This issue made me question a comment I made in our Hush coverage about characters that neither of these characters were mentioned in Hush, which is weird if we're really going to talk about everything dealing with Batman. They included Harold, but they didn't bring in Azrael.
They had to bring in Harold because he needed somebody to betray Batman.
But I mean, but they got every other character shoehorned in there. Come on. They could have found a way for Jean Paul Valley and Cassie Kane.
Well, I mean, the explanation would be, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Azrael number 100 had happened before Hush. And so John Paul Valley had already basically been written out, right? He was basically just a Denny O'Neill character. And so nobody really writes Jack Knight Starman after James Robinson ends the book, right? It's kind of that deal with John Paul Valley. Although recently there has been a return of John Paul Valley, but that was 20 years later. And I'm not defending leaving Cassie out, but I think Cassie did still have her own solo series at the time of Hush. And I also just assume that Jeff Loeb doesn't care about Cassie and feels like including Cassie would tarnish the nostalgia he's going for with Barbara Gordon and with Huntress.
Right. And you know what? If you are reading this issue, on page 10, Bob, there is an awesome illustration of Cassie hoisting this dude up with her legs. It is so badass.
Good fights in this comic. And I did like to see Batman with his killer instinct unlock courtesy of the key fighting both John Paul Valley and Cassie. That was pretty cool to me. But to keep it running, Matt, number six, personal effects. What's going down in that one?
So Batman investigates missing funds from a buried bank vault, only to discover that Oracle secretly hid a letter in the vault that revealed she is the biological daughter of Jim Gordon.
I actually like this run of comics, I think, better than Matt. This is truly the worst issue of the bit. And I do just want to frame it as a question, Matt. Which do you find more offensive? The very strange cover of this comic, or the weird reveal that Barbara is Jim's biological daughter, or the fact that we have this cover on a comic that reveals that Barbara is Jim's biological daughter? Of the three, which is in worse taste?
The cover is pretty bad. I will say that. It's a callback to The Killing Joke, where Barbara's shot by the Joker. She has her coffee in her hand. That's in the background in gray, so it's showing it's happened in the past. But then you've got Barbara in the forefront, in her wheelchair, slunched over, holding her stomach. The cover's just bad in general. It's just not a good cover. But the story itself, it was bad. It's real bad. I'm sorry. I don't have a problem with Jim being her biological father, but just the way it's handled here.
I do.
Oh, you do?
I mean, really? At least
it doesn't bother me that much.
If you were to start Batman over from scratch and you want to make her his daughter, fine. Doing it this way is so...
The way it's handled here is awful. There could have been other ways. I don't know. They could have found something.
I do want to praise one thing about this issue. The setup for this issue, that Batman is bumming around as a playboy and overhears this other rich guy confessing this crime and where the evidence is found. And then as Batman, he goes and he uncovers the evidence. I think that's actually a neat premise for a story. It's just a shame that it's wasted on this weird retcon about Barbara and Jim Gordon.
I want to point out there's two devices Batman uses in this particular specific comic. He does have a homing batarang that looks awful. Whoever drew the homing batarang needs to just go away. If you're going to make a homing batarang, at least make it look cool. And then the other thing, Bob, we have...
Matt, just remember, this is Paul Ryan, the man who gave us Sue Storm's boob window.
Oh, yeah. And then you have the bat spray, Bob, which is just bat mace. Okay. I don't know what he was going with these weapons he's letting Batman use, but they're weird.
On to number seven, oblation. Matt, can you define an oblation for us?
It's something you offer to a god, correct?
Excellent, excellent. And what goes down in this issue?
So Batman does Batman stuff while we find out that Leslie Tompkins and Alfred have been hooking up for decades.
Woo! I don't know. What do you think of Leslie and Alfred bumping uglies?
It seems unnecessary, but it makes sense. I always thought that Alfred was with Aunt Harriet or his lady friend. You remember Maggie Page?
I remember Maggie Page. Yeah, from that one episode of the animated series, as far as I remember, the one.
Yeah, Eternal Youth, where they go to the spa.
Run by Poison Ivy.
Correct.
Yep. Great episode. Not a great episode, but a fun episode.
Yeah, fun episode.
I agree with you that it's unnecessary to have Leslie at all these moments in Bruce Wayne's life. On the flip side, I don't hate her and Alfred being a couple, but like you, I could take or leave it. I did think it was a little weird how much this issue wanted to reconstruct Leslie and Alfred as Bruce's foster parents.
They're replacing Martha and Tom. It's supposed to be alone.
Yeah. Although I guess that's a lie of Batman is he's never alone. Right. Alfred's always there. The families are always there. For whatever reason, seeing Leslie interact with Martha Wayne on an earlier page was just fascinating to me.
Yeah, because I feel like we haven't seen a lot of that. We see Thomas Wayne interact with people.
And Leslie being doctors interacting makes a certain amount of sense. Yeah. I can't decide if this is hilarious or in poor taste. There's a club in this issue called the Rhythm Method. I don't think seven is that terrible. It's interesting. Unnecessary is a good word, but not terrible. Six is, to me, is the only one that's truly terrible. But shall we go ahead and move on to the piece de resistance, the main set piece of this set, issues 8 through 11, Transference.
The meat of the entire story here. What's been set? These issues have been set up in the previous issues, but in the way we're talking about with the case files, not so much with the actual content of the stories, but just the case file piece, the narrator. So Bob, what we end up happens in Transference in these issues, Batman discovers that Hugo Strange is bent on revealing his secret. So Bruce uses self-hypnosis to avoid revealing his identity while his Bat family handles all the heavy lifting.
If the other issues really focus on Batman's relationships to Batgirl, to Dr. Tompkins, to Azrael and Cassie Kane, these issues really focus on his relationships to Tim and Dick. The artist for these is Roger Robinson. I didn't know him before reading this, but he apparently worked on the Azrael series for a time. And he also worked on an Eradicator miniseries that I never knew there was an Eradicator miniseries. I wonder, is he responsible for Long Hair Azrael? I don't want to say he definitely is because it ran for 100 issues and I'm sure there were several artists, but maybe he's responsible for long-haired Azrael.
Roger Robinson sounds like the most 90s dude ever.
I was just going to say he sounds like a fifth grade teacher.
He probably is now.
We open up issue number 8 with a Catwoman doppelganger. What did you think about the Catwoman doppelganger?
I wish the doppelganger would have worn a different outfit, one of her older costumes, just to throw us off a little bit.
That could have been fun. We do have the real Catwoman calling the Batman family his acolytes, which I thought was funny.
They literally are his acolytes, yeah.
So did you know Hugo Strange was the villain coming into this?
I didn't know he was the main villain in this part. But I do remember.
Do you think, if you could put yourself back in the year 2000, do you think you would have gotten that it was Hugo Strange? Or do you think you would have been surprised?
I probably would have figured it out because there's only so many people it could have been at that point.
This is a direct sequel to a Legends of the Dark Knight story called Prey, which is, I haven't read in decades, so maybe doesn't hold up, but I remember thinking was awesome.
I got a question here, though, with Gotham Knights. Do you feel like, and we're going to be talking and getting into way further territory here, but do you feel like there's some unnecessary sequels to decent books here? They're just pushing things out that they want to try to get that. It's not really nostalgia. I guess it would be a nostalgia factor from the original run or that same spark or fire from the original run that took off so well.
Matt, this will kind of play us against type because I'm usually the one saying, don't do the sequel.
Uh-huh.
But I do think, I think I'm correct in understanding this, that post-crisis, Hugo Strange had only shown up in Prey. I mean, there is later a sequel to Prey called Terror that I'm not sure if I've read or not. That's also a Legends of the Dark Knight series, but it may have come out after this story. I think there's just Prey, so there's no other Hugo Strange stories. And I do feel you're not just going to have one Hugo Strange story. You're going to have a couple more. So in that sense, I think it's inevitable.
I didn't realize that he'd only had one appearance post-crisis. Hugo Strange didn't show up in Hush either, Bob.
He didn't. And I also, it is interesting, they list off all the villains who know Batman's secret identity. And at this point, it's just Bane, Ra's al Ghul, Shiva, Hugo Strange, and David Kane. I don't have any profound thoughts about it, but it's just an interesting list of villains who know the secret, right?
And that they actually list them in a comic book. So you have a definitive list as opposed to us just guessing or trying to remember who knows, who doesn't, based on past stories and what's actually canon and what's not. But Bob, were you okay with Dick's rationalization as to why they will not reveal Bruce's identity?
I think they mostly made sense to me. Was there one that stood out to you that didn't make sense?
Shiva just didn't seem to care.
I just read Denny O'Neil's Question series where Shiva factors heavily into, and she's never going to need anything from Batman unless it involves her daughter. That's the only circumstances in which she would ever even need anything from Batman. And yeah, I just don't see Shiva caring. I think Dick's dead right about that. I don't know if you would like the Question comic. I tend to think you would not, but the Lady Shiva scenes in it are amazing. She is so good in that comic. She could literally kill the Question at any moment, and she just doesn't because he somewhat interests her. And she says this on multiple occasions. It's such a cool dynamic.
Well, Bob, there is one strange scene in issue 8 that just bugged the crap out of me. It's on page 17. Dick and Tim are playing tag in Wayne Enterprises. Does this seem immature to you for their age?
Maybe for Dick, but not necessarily for Tim, because isn't he still just a high schooler? And Also, Dick's a kind of
plays tag in a business. Come on, like with an adult, like with a 30-year-old dude. Come on.
I don't think Dick's 30 at this point. I think Dick's probably mid-20s. I mean, this is still the period where Batman's 35, right?
A little weird.
To go to a more positive moment, at the start of issue number 9, I love that Strange reveals to Bruce that he knows, and Bruce just decides to keep playing dumb, which is both an interesting foreshadowing of where this is going to go and also just a really neat dynamic.
Bruce keeps up with this charade, and it leads to him trying to light Hugo Strange on fire. Apparently, Bruce Wayne carries a lighter, Bob. Do you know this?
Well, Matt, there's 4 things a gentleman should always carry, and that's a lighter, a pocket knife, a handkerchief, and a writing utensil. And you carry all 4 of those in case a lady needs them. It doesn't matter if you smoke or not.
Okay, Bob. All right. Well, that's good to know. I like that. I'll keep that in mind.
To go back to Dick being playful, I mean, this isn't being playful because he's worried about Bruce, but he's worried about Bruce, and so he needs to get to the top of Wayne Tower. And he just immediately goes full acrobat in his civilian clothes as an emotional moment and a visual moment. I thought it was really cool. I was going to ask, between Strange running into the firefighters and Dick charging up the stairs, I got year 1 vibes off this issue. I think that was intentional.
Totally was intentional.
To go to issue 10, I agree with you that this cover is bad, but I just cannot even come close to seeing it as bad as the Oracle.
Yeah, after you forcing me to go back and look at 6 and get a better look at it, okay, that looks awful, then flip. Going back and actually looking at it, analyzing it with a Killing Joke on it, issue 6 is the worst cover. But this cover just seems like it was like thrown together. It's just this random image of Catwoman in the forefront and then Nightwing diving off the side of the building.
You were saying that in the issue, they do this scene and it looks a lot better in the issue than it does on the cover.
On page 11 and 12, like Nightwing does take a dive off the building to prove that. Because what ends up happening is Batman jumps off the building after beating the crap out of Hugo Strange in the previous issue, and the Batmobile explodes. And we think that maybe Batman's dead. Did he blow up in the Batmobile or whatever? So Nightwing, we want to see if he dove off the building, he could avoid being blown up by the Batmobile. It was a neat scene. It was much more visually appealing here in the comic than it was on the cover.
The fact that it has this detective vibe or test vibe to it is cool.
I will say this to the artist, though. They did a fantastic job with the Bat Cycle. It's a straight-up copy of the one that they released for Kenner with the action figure line, with the Dark Knight collection back in the late 80s.
Speaking of Bat branding, I really like our newest member of the Batman family, which is Bat Strange, Hugo Strange in a Batman costume, sitting behind Bruce's desk in Wayne Manor. I thought that was a cool image.
It was a beautiful image. And Bob, I have always had this issue with looking at Strange and understanding why he is so buff. He's a big, buff dude. And I've always struggled. I struggled with this when I was reading Prey the first time, but I figured out why. It's because I was introduced to Hugo Strange in the animated series. In the animated series, he's this little dude. He's older guy. He's this feeble scientist, not this guy who really wants to be Batman. He's not trying to be the anti-Batman.
Well, and I think Prey is thriving off the incongruity of that. He wasn't buff before, but because he gets obsessed with Batman, he gets buff. I did enjoy the chase in the manor early in issue 11, and I enjoyed Strange's enjoying of it. Although, were you surprised that they went this amnesiac angle with Bruce?
I thought they may go towards doing something where Nightwing poses as Batman next to Bruce. And we get something like that, they clear it up. I mean, I don't know how stupid Strange is, but he would probably figure that out. But I thought they were going to go in that direction, which is why Nightwing was at Wayne Enterprises.
I really did enjoy, before Dick had figured out the amnesia issue with Bruce, he's miming Batier trying to get him to acknowledge it. That was very funny.
Yeah, another great visual, Bob, is on page 13, where we see Catwoman with an Uzi. That needs to just become the norm for Catwoman. She should carry an Uzi instead of a...
I didn't note that, but I can get behind it. Catwoman and an Uzi, that can be fun. To skip ahead to Arkham, Matt, do you remember how in Grant Morrison and Dave McKean's Arkham Asylum, Serious House on Serious Earth, every villain has a motto or a catchphrase? In the back of the book, there's a drawing with every one of them repeating their catchphrase.
It was pretty famous, yeah.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And I want to add Hugo Strange yelling, "I'm a model of mental health," to that. That should be his motto. I think it's beautiful.
That should be my motto at work. I'm just going to start yelling that. See what happens.
Matt, I believe compared to your coworkers, you are a model of mental health.
Thanks, Bob.
I do like that this issue pretty much posits that Dick and Tim don't need Bruce to defeat Strange. I thought that was nice.
The Gotham Knights takes the Bat family and gives them more autonomy. Is that the original reason for this Gotham Knights series to be more like a Bat family book?
Oh, yeah, because this came up earlier, and I just kind of wanted to defend it. So remember, this book is replacing Batman's Shadow of the Bat, which originally started to be a vehicle for, like, Alan Grant's slightly more twisted, slightly more adult version of Batman. And I think the idea was good. It was to try to do, like, a modern book about the Batman family, right? That's why Gotham Knights is the title, plural. But it was a modern Batman family book. Neither you nor I read the late 70s, early 80s Batman family book much. But from what I understand about that, it was like an anthology with stories about the Batman family. It wasn't an ongoing book about the Batman family, if that distinction makes sense.
This is just treading on that, showing you how the other characters in Batman's life are just as important as Batman himself.
Well, and you may disagree with this, Matt, but one of the things I like to get angry and yell at my boy Noah about, and I mean, he agrees with me, I think, or at least he doesn't want to provoke me anymore, so he doesn't disagree. But it really is astonishing to me that the Batman corner of the universe is the only corner of the DC universe that really is as popular as the X-Men and has the depth of characters that the X-Men do. And so it's crazy to me that there's not always a Batman family book. I get that you can't always have like a Stephanie Brown or a Cassie Kane or a Barbara Gordon or a Tim Drake book, but it just seems like there should just always be a Batman family book. Call it whatever you want, whether it's Gotham Knights or whether it's James Tynion's run on Detective Comics, where you're always using these great and popular characters. I just get a little frustrated that the DC doesn't better exploit that.
There's a lot of really good content they can do there. A lot of great characters they can develop more. And Bob, getting to the end of this issue, do you feel with the ending and Hugo Strange saying that he killed Batman and he is Batman, did that seem a lot like the ending to Batman Forever?
That's interesting. I didn't think about that, but now that you say that, I totally see where you're coming from. And as before, I was defending Azzarello being similar to Grayson. Now I'm going to defend Devin Grayson being similar to Joel Schumacher. Great minds, or in the case of Devin Grayson and Joel Schumacher, one great mind, one terrible mind, the terrible mind being Schumacher, think alike.
Rest in peace, Joel.
Well, I'm glad one of us is sorry.
Let's talk about this final issue, Damages.
This is a fill-in. It's written by Jen Van Meter. She's the wife of Greg Rucka, and she's an absolutely delightful human being. I've met her a couple times in Emerald City, although this is a long time ago. And my favorite work by her, she's got a great indie series called Hopeless Savages that I really like that came out from Oni Press. And then my favorite DC work of hers is she did a mini series called Black Lightning Year One that I think is really, really good. It's one of the best Black Lightning comics. Maybe we should discuss it sometime. It's just a fill-in issue. I don't have like strong feelings about it, but it's delightful to see something from Jen Van Meter. And then I didn't know the artist, Turbul is his name. Apparently he's an African-American guy, and he did work on the Terror Inc. miniseries with David Lapham, which is a fascinating miniseries. So nice to see Turbul doing some art.
Well, Bob, in this issue, it's focused on Oracle, and she's working with her father to take down a mugger who's targeting people who use canes, walkers, and wheelchairs.
It also really works on like Barbara and Alfred's relationship, which is very interesting. I didn't necessarily expect that was the direction the comic was going to go.
I was impressed too, Bob, that Wayne Manor did have wheelchair ramps installed. Did you see that? That was
yes, I did.
That was cool.
Well, I mean, Batman's really selfish. He didn't put those in after the Killing Joke. He only put them in after Nightfall.
Talk about making cuts. Overall, I'm going to say that I think Hush is better than this. You probably disagree, but I'm going to say the Hush is definitely, as far as the stories go, you got this secret person who's watching Batman, and what are they? And learning about it and learning about his family members and everything. I liked Hush better. It was just more coherent.
See, I'm going to disagree. I'm going to disagree because I think this gives a better survey of the Batman family, although it's also incomplete. We don't see anything about Huntress in this, for instance. So I'm not arguing it's a total view. I also think the revelation that it's Dr. Strange, Professor Strange, makes so much more sense than that it's Harold. Or then it's a D character named Tommy Elliot.
Well, it could have been Riddler. That would have been better.
Yeah, it could have been Riddler. I was going to ask if you wanted to rank this, but I guess maybe we should just, since it's only one more volume, we should read the second Devin Grayson and then rank him as a whole. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. Yeah, I do not want to rank this alone because it would probably be towards the bottom, way towards the bottom.
I was going to tell you to get out your coin because I think it's better than Hush. But let's see what we make of the second volume, and then our listeners can see where we stand and see where they stand themselves when we get there. For listeners, if they want to read along, next time we're reading the second collection of Devin Grayson's Gotham Knights. It's called Contested. And then if you're just reading electronic copies of the issues, That's issues 14 through 24 and number 32. Issues 25 through 31 are all tie-ins, but we're just doing 14 to 24 and 32.
All right, Bob. It'll be interesting.
All right. Well, I look forward to finishing out the Grayson run, and then I look forward to getting to the really bad stuff, the Scott Peedy and the A.J. Lieberman stuff.
That's going to be great, Bob. It's going to be great.
All right. Thanks for joining us, listeners. This is Uncanny Treks. I'm Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland. Have a great night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.